Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. Man, maybe a month ago or so, we knew what our podcast schedule was going to look like, and you went on Twitter, and you sort of did this Wheel of Fortune-type puzzle.
Yeah, it was a hangman.
For people to figure out who was coming up in, you know, the next 4, 5, 6 episodes of the podcast.
Right, so we had Moneybag Yo, we had Trevor Noah, we had Common.
But people only saw like an M or an A or like a G somewhere, right?
Not enough to give it away, but enough to keep people guessing.
And I think only one person successfully guessed that we were going to have Dennis Graham as our Father's Day episode. And that was our friend Jimmy Branley.
Yes. Well, two people did.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but we only gave one gift out.
And that was to our friend,
Jimmy Branley. But also, a lot of people thought that it might have been Dennis Rodman. That was the running bet.
I don't know what to tell those people other than, no, it's not.
We are going to fly out to North Korea. First chance we get.
Dennis Graham is on the podcast today, but interestingly enough, this morning I got an email from Jimmy Branley, and Jimmy was like, this is the perfect time for you guys to put out this episode. And honestly, I mean, it's just sort of a nice confluence of events that the Raptors won the world championship.
Yeah, but that matters for Drake, not so much. I don't know that Drake's dad is like a huge...
Well, I think Jimmy meant Raptors it more fan. Like the internet is like all things Drake, new Drake music.
Let me tell you something.
Drake is at the parade.
The internet has been all about Drake for 10 long years.
We were walking yesterday and you were remarking about the fact that Drake had this new song that he put out.
Well, we put out two, Omerta and Money in the Grave.
Right. And in Omerta, right? He talks about Benihana's.
Oh, well, yeah, he says that that Benihana's is pigeon food.
And you then put together a list
I said, I was like, you know, here are things that he likes. Here are three things he doesn't like. He doesn't like the Westin. He doesn't like the Intercontinental Hotel. And he doesn't like Benihana's, but he does like Cheesecake Factory.
Yeah.
So, like, what is the taste level here? I don't understand it.
And that tweet... Went viral.
Got in front of the right people and went viral.
So maybe this podcast goes viral because it's attached to Drake, but the way that we prepared for this podcast was to treat Dennis Graham, who is Drake's father, as his own man.
Yeah.
So we wanted to look at it like, hey, you're a human being. You've lived this life. You grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. You were a musician. You traveled across the United States and ended up in Toronto and married this woman. And here's how you looked at life. And let's hear it straight from Dennis Graham's mustachioed mouth.
Yeah.
And so this was a real treat for us because it's a podcast episode that we've been working on for
4 years.
4 years.
4 long years.
Shout out to us. But also, and just as importantly, shout out to Sophie Ash, who's our partner in this whole thing. Not only was she on text chains all about Dennis Graham and what he was doing and who we could contact and where he might be at any given time, but also she is the one who actually put the puzzle pieces together and got us to Calabasas, to his home, a couple weeks ago.
Which is crazy because, you know, for 4 years, you sort of can't find anybody in his camp. You don't know anything about, like, you know, we were reaching out to his, like, ex-girlfriend. You know, we were reaching out to, like, publicists who were not his publicist, managers who were not his manager.
There may be people who are listening to us for the first time and are like, who are these psychopaths and why did they have this one mission?
Well, I will say we didn't, like, show up at his house uninvited. That would be actual psychopathic behavior.
Right. We did not do that. We did show up at the assigned time, 3 p.m., a couple weeks ago.
He woke up at 3 p.m. because he had been partying until 5 a.m. with his neighbor Drake.
Yeah.
And by neighbor Drake, I mean actual neighbor Drake. They live right next door to each other because Drake was throwing a bunch of parties. His neighbors complained. And so Drake bought them out and put his dad in one house and his friends in another house.
Listen.
So now it's like a Godfather compound.
That is the perfect way to do it.
Yeah.
This is the brain that we wanted to pick.
Yeah.
You know, he is more than just the mustache, more than just any TMZ interview, and more than just Drake's dad.
So happy Father's Day to Dennis Graham.
Yes. Big happy Father's Day to him.
Happy Father's Day to Drake, actually.
Happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there, those who are fathers, have fathers, will be fathers,
our honorary fathers,
any of you and every one of you, we appreciate you tuning in to this episode and more. Again, if you're new to us, we have the really extensive catalog with everyone from Common last week and Trevor Noah the week before to Cardi B back in January of 2017 and Lil Uzi Vert and Rich Kleiman and Jemele Hill,
Big
and
Face Gary,
Swiss, I mean, Beats, and just
on and on and on.
A lot of episodes. Go check them out. They're everywhere you want to find them.
Before we get into the actual episode, which is very momentarily,
yes,
I just want to say that we have plans to take this on the road. We want to take this directly to you.
Much like we did when we did our Rockefeller show here in New York, when we interviewed DJ Semtex out in London, when we've had live events in LA, Atlanta, Texas, wherever.
Wherever. We want to take this to you, and the easiest way to get to you, to tell you all the things that are going on with us, where we're going to be, is for you to sign up for our newsletter. Be the first one to know where we're going to be performing. Be the first one to know who's going to be on the podcast. Be the first one to know all the things. It's The Real. Go to itsthereal.com. Sign up for our newsletter today.
Jeff, when do you want to get into this episode?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. Dennis's Mustache, a.k.a. Memphis Grizzly.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. Digging in the Stash Box, a.k.a. Ram Bam Thank You Ma'am.
Okay, this is Dennis Graham, guys. What's up?
Yeah, this is your third favorite podcast to waste time with. It's The Real. Dennis, what's happening?
Not much, man. Just here with you guys.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us into your beautiful home.
You're welcome.
So this has been a long time coming.
The longest.
Yeah, Sophie Ash put this into play, and man, you are the internet's favorite person. You're our favorite person, and we're so glad that we were able to make this happen. You know what? My brother Jeff over there, on last Halloween, we went to two different parties in New York. And he was not just dressed up as you for one, but dressed up as you for both.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Look at that. Hell, I thought that was me.
Wow. Yo, people online thought that I was you.
Look at that. That's amazing.
And then you can scroll through.
Yeah. Oh,
really? There's a whole bunch of them.
So yeah.
Because I did Dennis Graham two ways, because I did the suit with the... with the Jordans, but I also did the track suit with the hard bottoms.
Yeah. So he got the hat right, he got the do-rag right,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that is
the sunglasses,
crazy.
And most importantly, the mustache.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That is nuts.
How long have you had your mustache for?
There's a little story about my mustache. When we were growing up in Memphis, all my brothers, I think we started drinking around the age of 15.
Yeah.
And because I had a mustache, I was the only one that could go in a liquor store and buy liquor. Yeah. They didn't question me. No ID, no nothing, because I had a mustache. So.
Have you ever shaved your mustache ever since then?
No.
Never?
Never.
Well,
I don't even know what I look like without it.
So not even like if any Hollywood places like need you to shave it for a role, like it's off the table.
Yeah, no, it's not off the table if they want to pay money for me to shave it.
Yeah. There is a price.
Sure, of course I'll shave it for $2 million.
Yeah. So we love to hear a person's whole story. Let's go back to the very beginning. Where are you originally from?
I am from Memphis, Tennessee.
What was it like growing up in Memphis? I mean, that is a music city right there.
Yeah, it's a music city, but it was very, very depressing.
How's that?
It's just so backwards. So the racial tensions in Memphis when I was growing up in the 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, we got through it.
You said you have brothers. How many of there were you?
There were eight of us.
Wow.
Actually, nine. But I had a little brother to pass away. So.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Sudden infant death.
And where do you fall in line amongst the eight?
I am number three.
Number three. Mm-hmm. That's got to be wild on Thanksgiving. That's got to be wild on a lot of like family functions, right? That's a lot of...
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
that's a big family.
And yeah, we were raised by a single mother. And she was an officer and a gentleman with us. So,
yeah.
I mean, she kept us in line. So.
What was she doing for work?
My mom was a nurse.
That's long hours to begin with. Plus, she has eight children to take care of.
Right. Well, I had my oldest brother live with my aunt. And my brother George and I we were the overseer of the younger siblings. Mm. So that's what taught us discipline and how to raise the kids and cook and wash diapers.
Early.
Back then, you had to wash diapers. They didn't have Pampers.
So. Yeah. Do you remember where you were when you found out that Martin Luther King was assassinated?
Yes.
Where were you?
I was in Memphis. Right off of about 2 miles away from, 2 or 3 miles away from where he got assassinated.
The Lorraine Motel. Yeah.
How did the word get to you?
TV.
And what was the feeling like in the city after that?
Crazy. Everything was on fire. Tanks were rolling down the street. They had the National Guard. People were looting, and it was crazy. I've never seen anything like that.
Did you actually go outside during that, or were you...
I didn't actually go to where all the action was.
Right.
But... because we were so close, all the Army and National Guard had to come through our neighborhood to get to the actual site of the Lorraine Motel. So.
Did school just like sort of close? Did you get an extended period where you didn't have to attend class or anything? Or
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
But it's also like a different time. I feel like people will respond to like happenings differently now.
There were curfews, so no one was allowed to go out in the city anywhere.
Mm.
You know, so there was no school because everything was under a curfew then. So.
What kind of area did you grow up in Memphis? Like what section?
We lived right off of, there's a famous section in Memphis called Beale Street.
Mm-hmm.
We live right off of Beale Street.
Not like the Beale Street as it is now. It's not like touristy, a tourist area. Yeah.
No, it wasn't like that. It was more like it had all the clubs where you come out, sort of like Bourbon Street in New Orleans. It was all music clubs. And you walk down, and it was like a carnival. They had barbecue tents set up every day. It was like a carnival. So... and I used to jump out of my bedroom window every night after my mom went to sleep, and I'd go down on Beale Street and hang out. That's how I got into music.
So, yeah?
Yeah. Well, so who were you seeing, like, in those clubs?
B.B. King.
Ooh, wow.
Bobby Bland.
Wow.
God, it's everybody. Everybody that was affiliated with blues.
Well, what'd you know about Sun Records, and what'd you know about Stax back then?
I knew about Sun. Sun was basically for the white guys.
Yep.
Jerry Lee, Hall Perkins, Roy Orbison,
Elvis was there.
Elvis Presley.
Yeah, yep, man.
That's where they recorded it. And Stax was for the black guys. Otis Redding, Rufus Thomas, Al Green recorded at Royal Studios, my uncle's studio. Mm. But Stax was the place.
And even though it was like really a Stax city, did you respond to Motown music as well?
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, that was in our era, you know. The Supremes, the Temptations, and Smokey Robinson, and yeah, that was our era. So.
When did you actually start playing music?
I started around... about, God, I started playing the guitar at maybe about 10 years old because I used to play for, we had a revivals in our neighborhood on Wednesday night. And it was a group that used to get form in an apartment every Wednesday. And we would sing and I just strummed the guitar along with them. So I was about 10.
And that was acoustic?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did your older brothers play?
No.
No. So you were the first of the bunch.
I was the only musician in the family.
Mm.
But my brother Chris later watched us rehearse because I used to sing with a group in high school, Terry and Jerry Williams and myself. And we actually performed shows in high school, Temptations. We were singing the Temptations stuff.
So. What'd you call yourselves?
We didn't have a name.
Oh. It was just mysterious. Dennis Brown, wow. Yeah.
Terry,
yeah.
And Jerry Williams. So.
And then Terry went on to work with Al Green.
No.
No.
No. Terry passed away, actually.
No. Oh.
He got hit on the leg with a baseball and passed away. So.
Oh, my God.
caused cancer in his leg, and they wanted to amputate his leg, so he wouldn't allow that, and he passed away. But his brother Jerry is still alive. But no, he wasn't affiliated with Hal Green.
Gotcha.
I think you're probably talking about Teenie Hodges.
Yes, sorry, yeah.
Teenie is my cousin, and Teenie played the guitar for Al for a lot of years, and Teenie wrote all the songs. Most of Al's songs,
Teenie Love and wrote, Happiness.
Love and Happiness, yep. Tired of Being Alone, Take Me to the River.
Yeah.
He wrote all those. So.
Did you take pride in what Memphis had like to offer?
Of course, yeah. There was so many people that came through Memphis, and so much that happened in Memphis. It, man, it was like it's something to be proud of. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you gotta have pride. Yeah.
So, did you think that you were gonna like stay around Memphis, like as a home base for most of your life?
I didn't stay around Memphis. I left Memphis when I was 17.
At the end of high school, you just saw a brighter future somewhere else.
Right. I was working at the Holiday Inn, when I turned 18, I was playing piano at the Holiday Inn down on the river. And I met my first wife there. She was a cocktail waitress. Her name was Regina Roseberry. And we got married in Memphis. And because Memphis was such a, she was white. And because Memphis was so prejudiced, we decided to move to Las Vegas. Mm. So we moved to Vegas in 1971, I think.
What is Vegas in 71 like?
Not like it is today.
Yeah, no.
Nothing like it is today. The strip was, you had the Stardust, and then you had Fremont Street downtown, the Queens. But Circus was a tent. It was just a tent on a corner, a huge tent. So all the stuff that you see now, Vegas was nothing like that. And you couldn't get a job in Vegas unless you went before the Nevada Resort Union, which were 12 mafia guys. Oh. Even if you wanted a job as a dishwasher, a busboy, you had to go before these guys. So.
And what kind of job were you looking for?
I was playing piano.
Yeah.
Well, so I played piano at Stardust.
And so you went before them?
Yeah.
And they said, all right. And,
yeah.
And you got that gig?
Yeah, I played piano at Stardust for, a couple of years.
In a band or just like in the...
No, by myself. In a cocktail lounge. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And after that, I moved to Houston, Texas, and went to University of Houston. So.
Wow, the Cougars.
Yeah.
And what brought you down there, though? Like, you wanted to get a degree in... Yeah.
My wife's best friend lived there, and we got sick of Vegas, so we moved to Houston, and we both finished university in Houston. So.
What'd you major in?
Journalism.
Did you want to do print journalism or television?
No, I went for television.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did you end up getting a job in media?
I didn't. I started playing drums.
So, so at that point, you can play guitar, you can play piano,
right.
And you can play drums.
Right.
How did you get started playing drums?
Back then, before I left Memphis, there was you know, the round bathtubs, the metal tubs that people used to take baths in?
Sure.
Well, I used that as a bass drum.
All right.
And, you know, the old mops that people use. When they worn out, I used to use that as a mallet. And my cousin played a cardboard box. And so we had bass and...
You guys were like Fat Albert.
Yeah, exactly. So we played... that's how I got started. And one day, on Carson Street off of Beale Street, at the Sheraton Motel, James Brown was performing.
Whoa.
And this was like... This is what they used to do back then. Like James Brown, people like that, Roy Orbison, they played at the Sheraton. It was just a hotel. And James Brown heard my cousin and I playing a bass drum, a tub, and a cardboard box. And we had it so together that it brought him out on the balcony to listen to us.
You're kidding.
That's how Yeah, I mean, we really played well. You know, like, you know how people sit around with the plastic tubs now and play?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what we did. Same caliber. You know, so James Brown heard us, and he called me over. He said, "Hey, come here." I was a young kid, you know, like a little boy, actually. And he said, "Come here for a second." So I went over to the balcony, and he called his drummer outside on the balcony. And I said, "Hey, listen to these kids." And we played for him, you know. We stood down on the, and played. And he said, "Give him your drums. I'll get you some more." So that's my first set of drums.
What?
Wow.
Yeah.
You're kidding.
Wow.
You knew who James Brown was.
Of course.
Yeah, were, yeah. But you weren't, were you like freaking out?
No, I wasn't freaking out. No, no. No.
By the way, people can hear that in the background. That is your ringtone.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my ringtone.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. So so you're in Houston and you're playing drums now. But yeah. For who?
I played with a jazz quartet. It's four of us. Tex Allen.
And what do your in-laws think about like a career in music?
My in-laws?
Yeah, at that point.
I didn't know them.
Oh, really?
No, they lived in Paris, Tennessee, and some of the most prejudiced people you'd ever want to meet.
Damn. I was going to say, like, so did she just, like, cut off contact with her parents?
She kept in contact with her mother.
Mm-hmm.
Her father was, in her life.
Yeah.
She kept in touch with her mother, and her mother was one of the most prejudiced people you'd ever want to meet. We didn't have to deal with them, you know, like we didn't deal with them, so.
And how'd you find Houston as a city?
Hot.
Yeah.
Hot and sticky. Houston was, I had to make the best of it.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know.
Where did you see yourself, like, going? Like, where was the opportunity for you as a musician? I mean, it could have been, like, L.A., it could have been New York, I guess. It could have been
The Chitlin' Circuit, anything?
Well, no, I played in upscale jazz clubs.
Yeah.
I started doing the Chitlin' Circuit until I formed my own band, so. And that was later in life. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so there is an idea that, you know, a lot of people think that you have an affiliation with Grand Central Station.
No.
That you are brothers with Larry. Mm-hmm. What is the real truth of any relationship?
Larry there? Is my for one of my cousins. Larry is my cousin.
Were you close growing up in any way, or?
We were not close growing up. When I moved to California in 1977... Larry and I sort of formed a union then, but we've been talking ever since. You know, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, we weren't close.
You know, you and he look very much alike.
Yes.
Yeah.
Got the same mustache.
Yeah. He could also buy beer at a young age. So yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I saw a picture of Larry in New York doing an interview, and at first glance, I thought that was me. I seriously thought it was me. So he had the hat, and I wear it, everything. I mean, like.
Well, where do you get your suits?
I have my own suit line. It's from a company called Max Menswear. Mm-hmm. MAKS Menswear. Mm. That's where most of my suits come from.
And you just, like, say, I want, like, a red, you know, and yeah, I want to cut a certain way.
I tell them how to style them. I tell them what I want because, you know, I don't like the short, off your butt cut.
Yeah.
I like the Italian fit, the long one. So, but they make whatever I tell them to make.
When you're in Houston and you're playing jazz, do you think that jazz is your future, or are you just up for, like, whatever gig will come your way?
I was open for whatever. I mean, I did R&B gigs and everything. You know?
And were you into like writing your own music and starting your own groups and just sort of?
Not back then. Mm-hmm. I was merely a drummer. I was just a drummer back then.
And what do you think your best talents were as a drummer? Could you keep time well?
Yeah. I was in pocket.
How were your flams?
Yeah.
I was in pocket.
Yeah.
I was very in pocket. Yeah. You know? And I could do whatever anybody else could do. Put it like that. But we also did, I played in groups that played Led Zeppelin back then, all kinds of things. So.
And what's the scene like down in Houston? I mean, that's a spread out city.
Yeah, it was. I lived in Third Ward,
mm-hmm.
right off of a street called Westheimer. It was booming back then because all the clubs were going. I mean, like, it was really a beautiful club scene back then. So.
Did you get a chance to tour around?
Not during those times. I wasn't touring. I didn't start touring until I moved to L.A.
And so that came next?
Right.
From Houston to L.A.?
Well, from Houston, I went back to Memphis for a few months. Played the club scene there. I had a band called the Mandrake Band back in the day, and we played Midtown Memphis.
What kind of music?
We started doing Rare Earth, Otis Redding, R&B, a lot of R&B. It was a guy, Samuel Chico Skinner, Jerry Holloway. Samuel Chico played bass. Jerry Holloway played guitar, and I played drums. It was a three-piece band.
Were you guys nice?
Yeah, we were good.
Yeah.
I had a 14-room house there.
14-room house?
Mm-hmm. That's too many rooms. Yeah. What did you put in all the rooms?
I know, all your brothers?
I
what
there
happened?
By myself. Yeah. No, I lived there alone. Finally, Jerry and Chico moved in with me, you know, as roommates, and we practiced every day. So we became very good.
Yeah, you can choose a different room to practice in every day.
No, we had one room that we practiced in. In order to generate revenue, we set it up so we start renting it out. We had Al Green to rehearse there. We had anybody that came to Memphis came to my house to rehearse.
Really?
For their shows.
Who's the most random person that stopped by your house?
Oh, God. Bernard Purdy. Are you familiar with Bernard?
I'm not, no.
Bernard Purdy was one of the most flamboyant drummers I've ever met in my life. He's so good. I wouldn't touch a set of drums in front of this guy. That's how good he was. So, but we had everybody. We had Johnny Taylor. We had Bobby Bland. We had OJs. We had so many people come through
there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like a hotel.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
14 rooms.
Yeah.
I didn't rent it out for people to stay. Only for rehearsals.
Yeah.
Are you still with Regina at this time?
No.
That relationship's
that
over.
That ended in 1974. We got married in 71, and I left her in Houston. When I left Houston, she stayed behind.
Gotcha.
And she was a sheriff's department. She was a sheriff's officer.
Mm. So when you went back to Memphis, did you think that it was going to be a fresh start back there?
I went back just to regroup,
yeah,
to collect my thoughts, mm-hmm. and decide what path I was going to take. So,
and music was that path.
Music was the path. Yeah. So, only thing I've ever done.
Yeah. Well, so what told you to move to Los Angeles?
Being bored with Memphis. There was not enough happening in Memphis, and not enough money in Memphis to keep me there. So my brother, George, and another guy, Marvin Detman, and myself packed our stuff, got in the car, and drove from Memphis to L.A.
Wow.
Did you know anybody out there besides the people you were coming with?
I didn't, no. Well, George and Marvin ended up going back to Memphis. They couldn't handle the Hollywood life, but I stayed, and I stayed in L.A. for 8 years.
Okay, you lived in Las Vegas, you lived in Houston, you lived in Memphis, all big cities, all different in their own right, but
right.
Nothing's like Los Angeles.
No.
So you come out here, and what is your nightlife like? What are you doing during the day? Like, how do you survive as a musician?
I came out here and I met this lady. Her name was Mary Alice Brown. She was had a she played the Hammond B3 like mm-hmm. that. That's not a Hammond B3, but
right.
it's the same idea. And she played the bass with the pedals there, which is what that is. And I played drums, so it was like a 3-piece band because she was so good. I mean, like such an excellent player. And we played the. There used to be a restaurant and a bar combination out here called the Hungry Tiger. I met her. This is when I first got here. And, we had a jam session at a place out here called Jake's Back Room.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go to the jam sessions. This was the beginning of California. And I went to the jam sessions, and I sat in with Mary Alice Brown. So we played so well together that we formed a duo. And we played together for years. We did all the Hungry Tiger circuits from here in L.A. to San Francisco, Palos Verdes, Marina Del Rey. They had them all over California. So that's how I survived.
Did you think that there was like a recording contract in your future?
I didn't think about a recording contract then because I was just a drummer. I didn't really think about recording contracts until I moved to Toronto. And that's when I started singing.
Yeah.
I stopped playing drums and I formed a band and I started singing. So
you're out here and you're playing, but like, are there times when you think that it's just not going to work?
No. No, I never thought
you were all in.
Yeah, I mean, this was my life. This was my thing. I wasn't going to give up and say I'm not. I was doing well. I was making enough money to pay my rent. I had a car. I had
what kind of
I
car?
Had a life, huh?
What kind of car?
I had a Fiat Spider convertible. I bought that in the valley. I think I paid $1,300 for it, brand new. Yeah.
What'd you like best about Los Angeles back then?
The nightlife.
Yeah.
Nightlife was...
Well, that hasn't changed.
That was the only... No, that hasn't changed at all. I mean, I still like the nightlife. Right? Yeah. This is what I do. Yeah.
And so you're a whiskey guy, I'm guessing?
Back then, I think I drank vodka and club soda. But right now, I only drink white wine, so...
Mm.
No, white or red.
Yeah,
I'm a wine guy now.
Did you end up at any like random parties back then, like at mansions that you never thought you would be in?
Oh God, yes.
Yeah?
I went to a party with Joe Cocker.
Mm.
I went to parties with the Jacksons.
Wow.
We were everywhere. I mean, we played at their parties.
Really,
Mary Alice Brown and myself. Anybody had a party in Hollywood that didn't want a big band, they hired us.
Yeah.
Yeah, we played everywhere for everybody's party. I mean, yeah. So we played at Joe Cocker's party, and, oh, man, that's like in a mansion. It was just unbelievable. It was like we played for a lot of people. I mean, like,
so at the end of that period of time in L.A., what made you leave?
I did a gig with Jerry Lee Lewis in Toronto.
So how did that come to be, by the way? I mean, was there like a Memphis connection? Did
yeah.
You...
Oh, boy. This was... Jerry Lee was playing one night in Memphis at a club called the Hot Air Balloon. It was a Yosemite Sam's downstairs and the Hot Air Balloon upstairs. And his drummer... Tarp, my friend, good friend, Tarp Tarrant. Tarp was a drummer for Jerry Lee, so Tarp and I went across the street to the 7-Eleven for cigarettes, and Tarp goes in the 7-Eleven and tells the lady at the counter, I'm the drummer for Jerry Lee Lewis. I don't have any money, but I want to get a 6-pack of beer and a pack of cigarettes, and I'll come back and I'll pay you after we finish playing tonight. So the lady said, I don't care I don't care who you play for. I can't give you beer and cigarettes. So Tarp had a .22 pistol in his pocket. He pulls out the pistol and takes the beer and cigarette. Man, I left right away. No, I'm not doing this.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
He was nuts.
You're not an accomplice.
No, I'm not. I ran out the door as soon as he pulled the pistol out, so.
He really wanted that beer and cigarettes so
I
badly.
Know, yeah.
Oh, man. Every cop in Memphis was there in a matter of seconds.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So he got arrested that night for armed robbery. And
Jerry needs a drummer.
I finished the set. I finished the night out with Jerry Lee.
Holy shit.
That's
wow.
How that guy came about.
Did you know? And you knew Jerry before that?
Yeah. I mean, I used to go watch him every Sunday night. At the hot air balloon.
So how wait, how so, did you explain it
yeah,
to
how
him?
How did you explain it to Jerry, hey, your drummer is currently in jail?
I didn't have to explain it. My friend, I don't remember. I'm drawing a blank on his name. He was Jerry Lee's manager. Oh, shit. Look up Jerry Lee's manager, Jerry. God. And we hang out all the time. One of my best friends. God. I'm drawing a blank. I'll get it. I mean, it's going to come to me. But he was the one that set it up for me to finish that night out. So, wow.
So that established a relationship between you and Jerry.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you're just part of the crew?
Yeah, I just started playing with him in different places. He came to LA, and then we did a gig in Toronto. That's how I ended up in Toronto.
And what is Jerry like at that time? Like, this is like not his heyday.
Yeah, but he also, like, he killed it in the 70s.
Huh?
Like, Jerry was getting, like, number ones on the country charts in the 70s. So, like, he was still, like...
Jerry was a great ball of fire.
Yeah. Is that what you guys would close with?
Huh?
Is that what you guys would close with?
Is that what we would close with?
Yeah.
What,
great ball of fire?
Oh,
yeah.
No. I'm just saying him as a person.
Oh, yeah. he was a wild dude?
He was hell on wheels.
Oh, to all of you guys?
I mean, he's cool with us.
Yeah.
It was just rambunctious.
Yeah. Did he ever pull a pistol out at a 7-Eleven?
No.
Well, so you've been around Wilder.
I know, yeah. Well. So, okay, so that takes you up to Toronto. Had you been to Toronto before?
No, I hadn't been to Toronto at that point. Oh, J.W. Whitten. That's his name.
All right, J.W.
J.W. was my buddy. Yeah. Actually, I talked to J.W. God, I went to Memphis and I saw J.W. We had
is that right?
Together. Yeah. Of course, he's a much older guy now.
Yeah, yeah.
Chev, did you see J.W. Whitten?
No, I don't have reception.
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
we're going to take your word, though. J.W., yeah. Had you been to Toronto before?
No.
So what is that like going up there for the first time?
Was
it cold or was this during like the summer months?
No, it was during the summer months.
Mm-hmm.
We were at the Skyline Hotel. It's called the Skyline Hotel out by the airport. And that's where I met Sandy, my second wife,
mm-hmm.
Drake's mother.
Right. Yeah.
This
is like 1984?
1983, 84.
All right. And she is. Is she working there?
She was
just a fan,
a patron.
Okay,
at the bar, and I was looking for a pack of cigarettes.
Did you get it?
I was asking the bartender where could I buy cigarettes, and Sandy happened to be standing there. So she said, "Oh, here, have one of mine." And so that's how we met. So mm-hmm. We started talking.
Wait, what kind of cigarette was it?
It was a Quartz.
Okay.
Right.
So it wasn't like a Virginia
brand.
Slim.
Yeah, yeah.
Something that like, you wouldn't be... Yeah.
No, no Virginia Slim. No.
So you guys have that connection.
Yeah.
And is this something where you're like, all right, this is a relationship that will keep going? Or were you just like, cool?
No, we talked periodically. She was a school teacher. And we talked on the phone and... came back for another visit, and we finally hooked up and fell in love from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got married in 1985.
In Canada?
In Toronto.
Wow. Yes. Mm-hmm. And you stayed.
Yeah, her dad sponsored me. Ruben Shearer was his name. They sponsored me to stay in Canada.
So nicer in-laws.
Yeah, like the in-laws, up they fucked with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they were Jewish. they were the most, her dad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I never knew my dad. But this man was more like my father than anybody had ever been in my life.
Wow. I mean,
like, it was just so
super
beautiful.
Supportive, you know.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, and did you smash the glass at the wedding? Like, was it like a Jewish wedding?
I don't know. We didn't smash a glass.
Hmm.
I don't think. Maybe we did.
Maybe you were drinking, you know.
I was so drunk at the wedding, I don't remember what happened. I probably broke a few glasses. You know, like,
did you jump on the piano at all to play at the
wedding?
Did
yes, really? I played piano, yeah, that night. I did. We had our wedding reception at a place, where was it? Davenport and Yonge Street. It was at a restaurant called Luigi's. And we had our wedding reception there. And I just happened to be, that's where I got a job playing piano every night at Luigi's restaurant. So we ended up having our wedding reception there just due to the fact that I was already playing piano there. So.
What was your first dance to?
Oh, I don't remember all that. Shit, if I could tell you that, I'd be a mathematician by then.
Hey guys, we just want to take 1 second to pull back the curtain and say that if you like what you are hearing right now, or on any other episode, but if you're listening to other episodes, you won't hear this message, but if you like what you're hearing right now, then the best way to support us and this independent movement that we are doing is to go to itsthereal.com/shop and buy one of our items today. That means mugs, t-shirts, notebooks. It's all for sale and it's all good stuff. High quality is the only way we know how to operate. Go to itsthereal.com/shop and buy something today. Support your boys at It's The Real.
So what's the scene like up in Toronto then?
Ah, beautiful, man. I mean, that was so, the culture will change. It was so different. The nightlife was so different. It was just beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just booming. Yeah.
And so not long after, you have a son,
mm-hmm.
and that's Drake.
1986.
Yes. And what's it like raising a child up in Toronto?
Fabulous for us, because by then we had I started doing silk flowers like these.
Yeah.
And
as in like manufacturing them?
Not manufacturing, design.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did all these. Wow.
Well, that's dope.
So so we had a factory. We had a factory with 8 showrooms in it. Sandy's parents own the biggest mattress factory with baby car seats, baby cribs, all mattresses and foam. And so they had Bo Peep Nurseries, and they distributed it to everybody across Canada. And he had a empty warehouse that they weren't using. So I took that warehouse and turned it into an interior design place doing my flowers and stuff like that, and called Special Effects. And I did quite well. Well, I designed flowers for people's houses. I mean, I did huge things, not little bouquets.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah.
I did 10-foot ceilings in people's houses. I designed stuff like that. And I would try to do at least 4 houses a day.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So you're doing all right in Toronto.
Right.
How often would you get back home to visit down in Memphis?
Not often. I mean, I had no interest in running back and forth down. I would go down for a visit maybe once a year.
Yeah, yeah. To see the family and everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And were you still playing up in Toronto?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's where we rehearsed in my factory. I had eight children, so I had my drums, piano, everything set up in my office. I had a really huge office upstairs, and that's where I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of Drake with me holding Drake at a piano and a microphone in front of him. I had a pink sweater on.
Mm-hmm.
But that was in my office, so that's where we used to rehearse at.
Oh, that's dope.
And I would keep Drake during the day when he was a little baby in my office while I worked right outside the door designing. So.
Wow. What was Drake like as a kid?
He's a good kid. Yeah, he's a good kid. He never cried. He happy, smiling. He was a great kid.
How did you first recognize his creativity as a young kid?
Drake was different. He was different. We got him started into print work, like Toys R Us magazines or Sears.
Well, how did that happen?
He was
like,
a
did
model.
Somebody reach out and say, "I want to."
No, I told my wife that Drake had that look, and we should put him into doing modeling. And
was so Sandy on board like immediately?
Oh, of course.
Okay,
of course. Yeah, we had his pictures done and got him an agent, and there we go. He started working as a young kid. This was like 4 or 5 years old.
Regularly, too?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we took Drake to the sets every day.
So photographs in different, you know, print
right.
pieces.
When he was in the Royal Bank, had a banner of Drake as a kid. Yeah, it was crazy how he got started, actually.
Was there a natural progression into actual acting work there?
Yeah, he said, told me what he wanted to do. I think he was around 7 or 8. Dad, I want to do, because I was an actor in Canada also. I did a series in Canada called Night Heat. And I did movies. I did a few movies. So
what kind of roles are you playing?
I played a detective. I've been a reporter, news mm-hmm. reporter, mm-hmm. and
journalism degree.
Yeah,
acting. Yeah.
So when Drake became 7 or 8 years old, he said, "Dad, man, I want to do exactly what you're doing when I grow up." Of course, I wanted him to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
Thank God that didn't happen.
Well, I mean, you know, he is Jewish. So,
Yeah.
So I went to Kohl's, I think, and I started buying acting books. You know, little acting scenes, acting scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So we started reading. I started reading with him back and forth. Taught him how to laugh, taught him how to cry, taught him how to smile, how to be happy, how to be sad.
So you're looking at this 7-8-year-old kid and you just see it.
Yeah, he had it.
Yeah.
He had it. I knew he had it.
And then auditions would come?
Yeah. We took him to all kinds of auditions.
Like commercials,
commercials,
TV programs, yeah.
TV. And at the age of 9, he landed Degrassi.
All right. What did you know about that type of life for a kid like that? Like, did you have any expectations, and how did Degrassi meet that?
No, he was just looking for a part. Part in television. And he landed the part in of Degrassi at the age of 9 and stayed there to 16, I think.
Mm.
Yeah, so...
But yeah. Were you concerned with, like, how that would, like, affect his social life or how it would affect his studies or anything?
No, my whole thing for Drake was trying to get him to the star level, and Degrassi did that. No, I wanted him to be a star.
Yeah.
And he did that with Degrassi. So.
Were you going to set with him for Degrassi?
Yeah.
What was that like?
As a parent, it was wonderful to watch him do his scenes and, you know, like be on the set. Sandy and I both took him.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes she would take him, sometimes I would take him, and sometimes we'd go together.
Yeah.
So we hung on the set for quite a few years with him.
Were there any storylines that you were just like this is crazy?
The only one that got me, that made me feel some type of way, was when he got shot in the back.
Mm. Yeah.
That one sort of hit me.
Yeah.
Hit home, because thinking about the reality of that, you know, like that's one I didn't like.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
And then to see him like actually act it out, it's right. got to be like a very.
Right, right.
Did you have any type of feeling when he reunited the Degrassi cast for the recent music video?
I saw that and I thought it was wonderful. Yeah. I mean, it was so good to actually see all those kids that you knew as little kids to see them again as adults. That yeah. was beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful, yeah.
When do you and Sandy, you know, part ways, I guess?
We never parted ways. We never parted ways. I've never left them. I've been, if we, when I did move out, I was right in the next building.
Mm.
You know, and I came back. But I've never, I moved away from Canada. Drake was 17 when I left Canada. So, but there was never any leaving them. We've always been together. We've always been friends. There's never been any animosity amongst us. So, I've never left them.
Okay. And you look back at your time in Toronto with a lot of like love for the city?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, most definitely. That was the highlight of my life. Yeah, this is where I prospered most in my life.
So it's a very culturally diverse city.
Yes,
it's a very cool city.
Right, right.
And your son has a lot of responsibility for the mega city that it's become lately. But what was it like in the 80s, in the 90s, as a city itself?
Beautiful, beautiful. Toronto reminded me a lot of New York. It's the same type city as New York. The same nightlife, the same, it's multi-ethnic, everything. I mean, it's so New York.
Did it offer you a lot of opportunities as a musician?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I formed my band in 1985. I started playing as Dennis Graham and the North Memphis Band. That's one of the plaques that somebody sent me from Toronto there. And that was back when I first started.
And that's you singing?
Yes, yes.
So you hadn't been a singer before necessarily? Like
I've sang all my life. I started singing in high school.
Yeah, but front and center?
Front and center with Terry and Jerry Williams. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what made you want to sort of like reclaim that spot?
I was tired of playing drums, you know? it was at night when you're playing drums. I mean, it's such a strenuous instrument that you're sweaty.
Yep.
You're tired. All your legs are sore. Your arms are sore. Everybody else can walk off and party. But at the
You've
end of the night as a drummer,
down, like,
all you
want to
do is go and get some rest. You know? So
you started singing then?
Yes. Yeah. I performed Dennis Graham in the North Memphis Band.
And what is the song that you're most proud of from that time?
A song that I vowed never to sing again in my life. And that was a song by B.B. King. Thrill Is Gone.
Mm.
Well, I never sang that song again. I sang it for so many nights.
After you move from Canada, where do you end up?
I moved back to Memphis for a couple of years, a few years, because my mom was sick. Mm. And she was passing away. And Drake was the one that convinced me to do that. He goes, "Dad, man, I'm 17 now. I'm good, man. He said, "You're going through changes with..." I had a girlfriend named Joan. I said, "You're going through changes with her, man. Just your mom is sick. Just go back to Memphis, man, and hang out. You know, go and be with your mom. She's sick." So that released me from, you know, like the thought of not wanting to leave him.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me the thoughts and courage that I needed to leave him and go to Memphis and be with my mom until she passed away.
And how tough is that to go back home to a sick mom and a place that, you know, you have mixed feelings about, like, as far as the city?
It was a cultural shock, a difference, yeah, very different.
Heavy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
And so you were down there for how long?
I stayed in Memphis for over 6 years after I moved back.
And so how often, I know that Drake would come down to see you in Memphis.
Right.
You know, that was very, like, formidable.
Yeah.
Or formational. It was a really important time in his life.
Yeah, I would go back to Toronto and get him and bring him every year.
But, like, him coming down to Memphis, like, meant a lot to him.
Yeah.
And so, like, what places were you taking him around to?
He hung around the music scene. My uncle, Willie Mitchell, had a Royal Studios. And I started bringing Drake to Memphis as a baby in a car seat until the age of 17 when he was eventually helping me drive to Memphis. So that's how long he was coming back and forth. So.
When you bring Drake down as a 17-year-old to Memphis and he's meeting all these Memphis musicians, can you see the path that he's going musically?
Yeah, I mean, he had started writing at that point. He had started writing his own stuff. He had a... Oh, God, what was that song? That first, I used to love this song. He never, ever recorded it. Young and Reckless. Young and Restless. That was one of the first ones he ever did. And I've told him ever since, even up to now, he should record that again. But it was one of the nicest things I've heard from him. So.
What's the earliest experience you had seeing him in a recording studio?
Well, I mean, I kept him in a recording studio as a child, you know, because he was always at my uncle's studio, Royal Studios in Memphis. So, Drake used to have him on stage with my band. I did a Sunday matinee. And Drake was standing on stage at five, 6, 7 years old, Shake the Tambourine with the band.
So, yeah?
Yeah.
Was there ever a point as a kid where you were just where Drake was nervous to go on stage or to perform? Do you remember?
He had a thing that he used to do that used to bug me, actually. Not as a performer, but as an actor. And he would his nervous spot was always wiping his mouth. Well, I could tell he was nervous. So,
would you go over to him at those times and say something to him, or
no,
were you just like
just
leave
him
alone and let
home.
Him process it?
I'll tell him when we get home. Man, you gotta stop wiping your mouth all the time. That's a sign of nervousness. Huh?
What was your relationship with rap in, let's say, like the 1990s? Did you have an appreciation of it?
I had no relationship with rap until Drake turned me on to it.
Wow.
Now,
so if it came on the radio, you changed the station.
I listened to something different. I listened to Andrea Bocelli. I listened to all types of music.
Yeah.
I had a wide array of music that I listened to.
Were you surprised then when he started rapping? I mean, you had other influences that were going into him.
Yeah, he's not singing R&B. He's not singing
right,
soul.
Right. No, I mean, he did it so...
He's not singing opera like Andrea Bocelli. Yeah,
he did it so well. He did it so well that I had to go with the flow. You know, he did it very well. I mean, like, he was so good at it. even as a child, I got a video of him and my brother Chris. They're singing, and Drake is doing a song by the Fugees. Ready or Not, Here I Come.
Yeah.
And he was
doing
which
is really
so
a Delphonic song, but all right.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, did you have an appreciation of, like, the way that sampling would work, that they would take these known songs and just put their own twist on it?
Sure. Yeah. Of course, yeah.
So Drake begins his career, and there's momentum behind his career, and people take interest. Do you have any reservations about him getting into the music business, having been a musician for your whole life?
Nope.
Were for it? Whatever he...
I was all for it because I knew exactly where he was going.
Cash Money Records.
Yeah.
Cash Money Records. That's it. 2009, that happened, and... It's been all uphill from there.
Well, how did you celebrate when he signed?
I celebrated by going on the tour with him.
Did you really?
Yeah. It was so exciting. I mean, like, this was one of the most exciting times ever. I mean, like, this was it. It was a signed, sealed, and delivered deal. You know what I mean? So it was really exciting. Yeah.
Well, how were you traveling around the country? On buses?
Tour bus.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, like, how different was your tour experience than his?
His was more extravagant. mine was a little low key.
Mm-hmm.
His touring was real star type touring. So.
But was there any adjustment for you? Because, you know, this is like basically like you're acting like a star on the road as well. Like you're part of the
entourage. Yeah. I mean, like I had been there by then. I mean, like. I mean, I signed autographs and took pictures with people long before Drake. You know,
yeah.
Like, but it just elevated. It just elevated after that.
Yeah.
You know, like after he became a star, like this was like some number one star stuff. You know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
What was the first moment where you just sort of your jaw dropped and you're like, this is even bigger than I could have imagined?
Oh my God, so many. I can't remember the first one, but yeah, man. Like we this was on a Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley level, especially today. I mean, he surpassed everybody and everything. So, you know, like this is on a level that people dream of. You know what I mean? So,
did you ever get on the phone with Sandy and just, like, sort of take a step back and think, you know, look at what he did?
We've done it in the beginning. We talked about it, Sandy and I. Can you believe this? Unbelievable. This is hard to wrap anything around, you know. Like,
that's got
to
be just beyond satisfying.
Yeah. This is, I mean, look at us now.
Yeah.
Look at us now.
Well, right. Also, I mean, like, but when Drake would rap about you and your relationship with him.
Right.
Did you know that he was going to be doing that? Or did it sort of like, it would come out?
No, Drake, we had a conversation about that also. I said, Drake, you got to stop this, man. You know that never happened. He goes, Dad, listen, man. Just go with the flow. This shit sells records. So,
is there anything that you feel you can tell Drake now that maybe he hasn't experienced, or anything that you can show him the way on at this point?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. If he doesn't know by now, he'll never know. And he's such an entrepreneur. He's such a wise businessman to the point of. He doesn't need my help. Yeah.
Beyond his awards, beyond his records, beyond who he is as a musician, what makes you the most proud of him as a human?
His heart, his humbleness, he's down to earth. He's got our genes, Sandy and myself. We're the same way. We're not bad people. We don't. We're not assholes. We're nice to everybody. We love everybody. And Drake has that same type heart. So, the three of us, we're the three amigos. Mm-hmm. So, it's all good.
Yeah. Well, now you guys are neighbors.
Yes.
That's really nice. And so, I know you were at his place last night, and he had a party.
Right.
How often does he come over here?
Do you know that since I've been here?
So 6 months in this house.
Right.
Yeah.
Drake has been out of town, and he has never set foot in here.
Wow.
We've been in here more than he has.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, he told me when he was on finishing the tour, Dad, show me a video of your place. Oh, I showed him. I go, damn, man, I got to come. I got to come. But he's just so busy.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I understand. At first, I felt like, damn, I mean, like, you don't even have the time to come and say hi to me. But I understand how busy it is.
So you've lived in Los Angeles now for how long?
I've been back here for 4 years.
4 years.
Wow.
You have been known to frequent different...
You go out to all the clubs.
Yeah, late night clubs.
Yeah.
You're seen. We've been at parties, and then we'll leave, and someone's like, oh, you left too early because Dennis Graham showed up, right? And you're known in this city for that. Do you ever sit down if you end up at some place that has a piano and just, you know... play those keys?
Oh, I have.
Yeah. Is that right?
Sure, sure. I have. Yeah, yeah.
If people ask for requests, will you play something?
No.
No,
no, I don't. I don't do it like that anymore. I stopped playing the piano. I haven't played in so long. I used to play in cocktail lounges.
Sure.
But by me not playing, I mean, I just started now working on my left hand again with this piano.
Oh, you lost it a little bit.
Yeah, I lost my left hand, yeah. And until I start... practicing on a regular basis, I won't get it back. But mm-hmm. I'm feeling so good now that I'm finally getting it back.
And you've been recording?
Yes. I have a recording studio back here.
Right on.
Yeah.
We know what you've put out before.
Right.
What do you have on the way?
I am about to have a video release for my new single. That on that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be releasing that in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
And what inspires you musically at this point?
Just doing what I love. I mean, like sitting in my studio and making beats.
Yeah.
If I make a beat that I think is going to go, or I'm putting it out. You know, that's how they come about. That song, the last song, that on that.
Yeah.
That I did. I wrote that 10 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
And then you rap on that?
No, I'm not rap.
You speak rhythmically, I guess.
I'm talking.
Yeah.
I'm talking. I don't know if I would call it rapping.
Well, you're speaking rhythmically, I guess.
Yes, speaking rhythm. Rhythm.
Yeah. So if we caught you on like a Sunday afternoon, what are you listening to?
Frank Sinatra.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Does that bring you back to Las Vegas?
Vegas,
yeah. I love Frank. And that's soothing for me during my downtime. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
You've had this cascading effect off of like Drake's superstardom. You are now given like new life to your music.
No. You don't think so? That's not true.
Okay.
That's not true. I'm doing me.
Yeah.
It's had nothing to do with Drake. It had nothing to do with Drake's stardom. I was in music long before Drake, and I taught myself to produce different tracks and stuff like that. And when I started producing tracks, I decided, well, hell, I'm going to put it out. That sounds really good. But it has nothing. I mean, Drake's stardom, of course, it elevates me because people know me and my affiliation with Drake. But as far as me using him to...
Oh, no, I didn't mean it like that.
I don't think he meant it like that, yeah.
I meant like... my apologies. I didn't mean it like that. In addition to your music now, you're also a personality that can appear on television.
Right.
And you were telling us before that you have a new program that you're working on right now.
Right.
In which you're, unlike this, you're on the other side. You're interviewing.
Yeah, I'm interviewing different people. Yep. It's called Fame and Family.
And what
so you're talking to like Master P, you're talking to Dion Cole?
I'm talking to... The idea of the show is to talk to the parents of superstars and to club owners, restaurant owners, mom and pop shops.
You've shared a lot of stories today.
Right.
How many do you think that Drake has heard over the years?
All of them.
All of them? Yeah. Is he tired of them?
And more. And more. When Drake was growing up, I told Drake more stories that I made up in my head. I can go, he can walk in here right now and I can start talking about something and go, oh, Dad, please don't start. Please don't start. Because I mentally took him down through there.
Yeah.
I mean, like by telling him, by making up fantastic stories of me being in a tree in Vietnam, and the Viet Cong were after me, and I flew the helicopter over.
Wait, so that did not happen?
No, it didn't.
Did you just skip over?
Yeah,
that.
We skipped that part. Yeah, like, you know, I was between Las Vegas and yeah. Houston.
Oh, right. Yeah, I went to Vietnam for a couple years.
But I made up more stories to tell Drake. You could ask him. Yeah. He said he knows. He goes, "Oh my God, my dad's fixing to start."
Does he like you doing interviews?
It depends on what I say. I don't like discussing Drake in my interviews because people look for the negative things to put out in the interviews, and I don't like that. So I refuse to go into anything in detail about Drake because most interviewers will pick the negative parts out to try to get to make it controversial.
Headlines. Yeah, yeah. People want headlines.
That's something I don't like. You know, well.
Do you appreciate or dislike or somewhere in the middle TMZ finding you on the street and trying to, you know, engage with you?
TMZ follows me everywhere. Anytime I walk outside of the club, they want to talk to me and ask me questions. It's and they have twisted some of my things around that has caused Drake and I to have friction, you know. So and that's where I've almost gotten to the point where I won't answer any negative questions that you're asking
me. I do wonder, like, when, because you watch, you know, obviously, like, them chase around people, and like, right, if you refuse to talk to them, what do they do?
Nothing. They can't do anything. You go on and talk to somebody else. Mm-hmm. I'm not discussing that subject with you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And, if you want to talk to me about me and my music and my lifestyle, what I do, that's fantastic. I will discuss that with you. But if you want to get into Drake and something negative about anybody, I mean, I'm not going to discuss that.
Mm-hmm.
You live, you learn.
Yeah.
You know?
Looking back now, are you the same guy that you were growing up in Memphis?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Deep in your heart, you're still a Memphis guy.
I'm still me.
Yeah.
I've never wavered from that. So, I've been me all this time. I'm not going to start changing now.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people, when they're thrusted into stardom, they become jerks. We have never changed. We've never... we're not becoming assholes, or... We have stayed the same, and I'm so proud of that. So,
when's the last time you wore like a basic outfit? I feel like you're somebody who likes a lot of like extravagant, you know, individual outfits. When's the last time you wore just like a basic outfit?
Today.
This is basic for you?
Yeah.
You look, you're on like the Rough Riders tour.
I know, yeah.
What?
Well, listen, you've lived quite a life to this point, and you've come a long way since making drums out of a bathtub, yeah, and getting drums from the Godfather of Soul to hitting the road and heading up north and back down south and crisscrossing this country and other countries. Listen, congratulations on a life well lived so far,
and
everything
much,
you've
man.
Done to you know, make your career and other people's, you know, lives better, and we appreciate you inviting us into your house.
Wow, thank you, brother.
Yeah.
So glad you guys came. Thank you for the interview. And anytime.
Right on.
Yeah. Thank you very much. We can all go to Vietnam. We'll get in the house.
That's right. Yeah.
I'll fly you guys over sometime.
Thanks so much, Dennis.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this new episode of A Waste of Time with It's The Real Jeff. People want to find out more about us. I'm Eric. You're Jeff. Together, we are It's The Real. If people want to find out more about this podcast of ours, it's called A Waste of Time with It's The Real. Not Waste of Time, not A Waste of Time podcast. It's called A Waste of Time with It's The Real. Jeff, people want to find out more about what's going on with us, where can they go?
You can always go to itsthereal.com, itsthereal.com. You can also go to itsthereal.com/shop and support your boys, It's The Real. Cop some merch today. You can also sign up for the newsletter there. You can always find all of our old episodes and our new ones by going on any streaming platform. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, that's where you can find all of our other episodes.
Apple Music, Spotify, CastBox, Google Play, wherever it's streaming, YouTube, wherever.
And you can also find us at It's The Real on Twitter, at It's The Real on Facebook, at It's The Real on Instagram.
Jeff, there's a lot of people that we feel like shouting out today because there's a lot of people who are supporting us online. So, who checked in on Twitter and who are we shouting out?
I want to shout out AZ at Money Hungry. I want to shout out Devin No One Cares, who listens to us on Mondays. I want to shout out You Gotta Love Cam, our guy who works with Upscale Vandal.
Yeah.
I want to shout out Mike the Manager. I want to shout out Brian Hasty, AM Pash _. Kicks Fan Account, that's the Bodega Box Office, our guys over in Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah.
Shout out to Keith _A, a longtime fan. Shout out to the Junk Drawer Podcast out in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Shout out to Ski.Reed, who said, how can I tag every single person ever in spreading the word? I also want to shout out Shake Skates, who shouted out Maul from the Joe Budden Podcast. I want to shout out Gerard Hussein. I want to shout out Opal Heights, who said that Lil Tunchi, Lil Wayne should listen to our podcast.
I agree.
He would learn a lot about the behind the scenes of this industry. I want to shout out Jose, Slopmaster00 over in LA.
Longtime fan.
I want to shout out A Tribe Called Blessed, that's Born Jamaican 18. I want to shout out Pierre Productions.
Another longtime fan.
I want to shout out Bam Beats, who I haven't seen in a little while, but always happy to see him when we do. I want to shout out In Spite Of. I want to shout out Cherry Poppins, our girl from Philadelphia.
The Officially Street Podcast.
Brat! I want to shout out Kregarious. I want to shout out the Young Lion Blog from Nevada,
who just interviewed our guy, Black Trey. Check that out.
I want to shout out Robbie Digital, who we just saw last week at the Industry Friends Party.
Big shout out to Robbie, and big shout out to Robbie's shoe collection.
Ooh, okay. I want to shout out Krathel. Krathel? Krathel. Whatever. I want to shout out Bob Fuentes, Multimedia Bob. Also, Brandon Flores, who said that our podcast is a dope pod. I want to shout out Ken Drippy Jr., Rod Almighty, who says, not for real, for real. Rmizzle _ what's his name? Cool Married What? I want to shout out D.A. Davis BK, Surfside Luke, produced by Rex, who put four people onto our podcast. I want to shout out Jeswinder Verdi over in London.
Yes, sir.
I want to shout out IMJ Goaty out in Sacramento, who said that Sacramento is sort of lame.
Damn.
But he still lives there, and he's still killing it over there, so why not? And I also want to shout out Hugo Dynamite, the Usman, who said, I'm going to be upset for Money Hungry if he doesn't get the shout out because he hit it early. So shout out to both of them.
We're back again in 7 days. Jeff, as always, now for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
We'll see you guys next week.